Chapter 19. Meet in a tavern on the quays of the old port. The antique city of Massilia had surely never, since the days of the earliest Phoenicians, known an odder set of ship owners. We met to discuss and settle the plan of operations for each voyage of the Tremolino. In these operations a banking house too was concerned, a very respectable banking house. But I am afraid I shall end by saying too much. Ladies too were concerned, I am really afraid I am saying too much, all sorts of ladies, some old enough to know better than to put their trust in princes, others young and full of illusions. One of these last was extremely amusing in the imitations she gave us in confidence of various highly placed personages she was perpetually rushing off to Paris to interview in the interests of the cause pour el rey. For she was a Carlist, and of Basque blood at that, with something of a lioness in the expression of her courageous face, especially when she let her hair down, and with the volatile little soul of a sparrow dressed in fine Parisian feathers, which had the trick of coming off disconcertingly at unexpected moments. But her imitations of a Parisian personage, very highly placed indeed, as she represented him standing in the corner of a room with his face to the wall, rubbing the back of his head and moaning helplessly, "Rita, you are the death of me," were enough to make one, if young and free from cares, split one's sides laughing. She had an uncle still living, a very effective Carlist too, the priest of a little mountain parish in Guipuzcoa. As the sea-going member of the syndicate whose plans depended greatly on Dona Rita's information, I used to be charged with humbly affectionate messages for the old man. These messages I was supposed to deliver to the Aragonese muleteers who were sure to await at certain times the Tremolino in the neighborhood of the Gulf of Roses, for faithful transportation inland, together with the various unlawful goods landed secretly from under the Tremolino's hatches. Well, now, I have really let out too much, as I feared I should in the end, as to the usual contents of my sea cradle. But let it stand. And if anybody remarks cynically that I must have been a promising infant in those days, let that stand too. I am concerned, but for the good name of the Tremolino, and I affirm that a ship is ever guiltless of the sins, transgressions, and follies of her men. XLII. It was not Tremolino's fault that the syndicate depended so much on the wit and wisdom and the information of Dona Rita. As he had taken a little furnished house on the Prado for the good of the cause pour el rey. She was always taking little houses for somebody's good, for the sick or the sorry, for broken down artists, cleaned out gamblers, temporarily unlucky speculators, view Amos old friends, as she used to explain apologetically, with a shrug of her fine shoulders. Whether Don Carlos was one of the LD friends too, it's hard to say. More unlikely things have been heard of in smoking rooms. All I know is that one evening, entering incautiously the salon of the little house just after the news of a considerable Carlist success had reached the faithful, I was seized round the neck and waist and whirled recklessly three times round the room, to the crash of upsetting furniture and the humming of a valse tune in a warm contralto voice. When released from the dizzy embrace, I sat down on the carpet suddenly, without affectation. In this unpretentious attitude I became aware that J.M. K. B. had followed me into the room, elegant, fatal, correct and severe in a white tie and large shirt front. In answer to his politely sinister, prolonged glance of inquiry, I overheard Dona Rita murmuring, with some confusion and annoyance, "Vous êtes bien, monsieur. Voyons. Qu'en aucune consequence." Well, content in this case to be of no particular consequence, I had already about me the elements of some worldly sense. Rearranging my collar, which, truth to say, ought to have been a round one above a short jacket, but was not, I observed felicitously that I had come to say goodbye, being ready to go off to sea that very night with the Tremolino. Our hostess, slightly panting yet, and just a shade disheveled, turned tartly upon JMKB, desiring to know when he would be ready to go off by the Tremolino, or in any other way, in order to join the royal headquarters. Did he intend, she asked ironically, to wait for the very eve of the entry into Madrid? Thus by a judicious exercise of tact and asperity we re-established the atmospheric equilibrium of the room long before I left them a little before midnight, now tenderly reconciled, to walk down to the harbor and hail the Tremolino by the usual soft whistle from the edge of the quay. It was our signal, invariably heard by the ever-watchful Dominic, the padron. He would raise a lantern silently, to light my steps along the narrow, springy plank of our primitive gangway. "And so we are going off," he would murmur directly my foot touched the deck. I was the harbinger of sudden departures, but there was nothing in the world sudden enough to take Dominic unawares. His thick black mustaches, curled every morning with hot tongs by the barber at the corner of the quay, seemed to hide a perpetual smile. But nobody, I believe, had ever seen the true shape of his lips. From the slow imperturbable gravity of that broad-chested man you would think he had never smiled in his life. In his eyes lurked a look of perfectly remorseless irony, as though he had been provided with an extremely experienced soul, and the slightest distension of his nostrils would give to his bronzed face a look of extraordinary boldness. This was the only play of feature of which he seemed capable, being a southerner of a concentrated, deliberate type. His ebony hair curled slightly on the temples. He may have been 40 years old, and he was a great voyager on the inland sea. Astute and ruthless, he could have rivaled in resource the unfortunate son of Laertes and Antique Lee. If he did not pit his craft and audacity against the very gods, it is only because the Olympian gods are dead. Certainly no woman could frighten him. A one-eyed giant would not have had the ghost of a chance against Dominic Cervoni, of Corsica, not Ithaca, and no king, son of kings, but a very respectable family authentic Caporali, he affirmed. But that is as it may be. The Caporali families date back to the 12th century. For want of more exalted adversaries, Dominic turned his audacity fertile in impious stratagems against the powers of the earth, as represented by the institution of custom houses, and every mortal belonging thereto, scribes, officers, and guardacostas afloat and ashore. He was the very man for us, this modern and unlawful wanderer with his own legend of loves, dangers, and bloodshed. He told us bits of it sometimes in measured ironic tones. He spoke Catalonian, the Italian of Corsica and the French of Provence with the same easy naturalness. Dressed in shore togs, a white starched shirt, black jacket, and round hat, as I took him once to see Dona Rita, he was extremely presentable. He could make himself interesting by a tactful and rugged reserve set off by a grim, almost imperceptible, playfulness of tone and manner. He had the physical assurance of strong-hearted men. After half an hour's interview in the dining room, during which they got in touch with each other in an amazing way, Rita told us in her best grand dame manner, "Acil ai parfait," said Tom. He was perfect. On board the Tremolino, wrapped up in a black caban, the picturesque cloak of Mediterranean seamen, with those massive mustaches and his remorseless eyes set off by the shadow of the deep hood, he looked piratical and monkish and darkly initiated into the most awful mysteries of the sea. XLIII. Anyway, he was perfect, as Dona Rita had declared. The only thing unsatisfactory and even inexplicable about our Dominic was his nephew, Caesar. It was startling to see a desolate expression of shame veil the remorseless audacity in the eyes of that man superior to all scruples and terrors. "I would never have dared to bring him on board your balancelle," he once apologized to me. "But what am I to do? His mother is dead, and my brother has gone into the bush." In this way I learned that our Dominic had a brother. As to going into the bush, this only means that a man has done his duty successfully in the pursuit of a hereditary vendetta. the feud which had existed for ages between the families of Servanii and Brunicii was so old that it seemed to have smoldered out at last. One evening Pietro Brunacci, after a laborious day amongst his olive trees, sat on a chair against the wall of his house with a bowl of broth on his knees and a piece of bread in his hand. Dominic's brother, going home with a gun on his shoulder, found a sudden offense in this picture of content and rest so obviously calculated to awaken the feelings of hatred and revenge. He and Pietro had never had any personal quarrel, but, as Dominic explained, all are dead cried out to him. He shouted from behind the wall of stones, "O Pietro! Behold what is coming!" And as the other looked up innocently, he took aim at the forehead, and squared the old vendetta account so neatly that, according to Dominic, the dead man continued to sit with the bowl of broth on his knees, and the piece of bread in his hand. This is why, because in Corsica your dead will not leave you alone. Dominic's brother had to go into the Maquis, into the bush on the wild mountainside, to dodge the gendarmes for the insignificant remainder of his life, and Dominic had charge of his nephew with a mission to make a man of him. No more unpromising undertaking could be imagined. The very material for the task seemed wanting. The Servanus, if not handsome men, were good sturdy flesh and blood. But this extraordinarily lean and livid youth seemed to have no more blood in him than a snail. Some cursed witch must have stolen my brother's child from the cradle, and put that spawn of a starved devil in its place, Dominic would say to me. Look at him. Just look at him. To look at Caesar was not pleasant. His parchment skin, showing dead white on his cranium through the thin wisps of dirty brown hair, seemed to be glued directly and tightly upon his big bones, without being in any way deformed. He was the nearest approach which I have ever seen, or could imagine, to what is commonly understood by the word monster. That the source of the effect produced was really moral, I have no doubt. An utterly, hopelessly depraved nature was expressed in physical terms, that taken each separately had nothing positively startling. You imagined him clammily cold to the touch, like a snake. The slightest reproof, the most mild and justifiable remonstrance, would be met by a resentful glare, and an evil shrinking of his thin dry upper lip, a snarl of hate to which he generally added the agreeable sound of grinding teeth. It was for this venomous performance, rather than for his lies, impudence, and laziness that his uncle used to knock him down. It must not be imagined that it was anything in the nature of a brutal assault. Dominic's brawny arm would be seen describing deliberately an ample horizontal gesture, a dignified sweep, and Caesar would go over suddenly like a ninepin, which was funny to see. But, once down, he would writhe on the deck, gnashing his teeth in impotent rage, which was pretty horrible to behold. And it also happened more than once that he would disappear completely, which was startling to observe. This is the exact truth. Before some of these majestic cuffs, Caesar would go down and vanish. He would vanish heels overhead into open hatchways, into scuttles, behind upended casks, according to the place where he happened to come into contact with his uncle's mighty arm. Once it was in the old harbor, just before the Tremolino's last voyage, he vanished thus overboard, to my infinite consternation. Dominic and I had been talking business together aft, and Caesar had sneaked up behind us to listen, for, amongst his other perfections, he was a consummate eavesdropper and spy. At the sound of the heavy plop, alongside horror held me rooted to the spot, but Dominic stepped quietly to the rail and leaned over, waiting for his nephew's miserable head to bob up for the first time. "Oh, Caesar," he yelled contemptuously to the spluttering wretch, "catch hold of that mooring hawser, Charon." He approached me to resume the interrupted conversation. "What about Caesar?" I asked anxiously. "Canalia. Let him hang there," was his answer. And he went on talking over the business in hand calmly, while I tried vainly to dismiss from my mind the picture of Caesar steeped to the chin in the water of the old harbor, a decoction of centuries of marine refuse. I tried to dismiss it, because the mere notion of that liquid made me feel very sick. Presently Dominic, hailing an idle boatman, directed him to go and fish his nephew out, and by Caesar appeared walking on board from the quay, shivering, streaming with filthy water, with bits of rotten straws in his hair, and a piece of dirty orange peel stranded on his shoulder. His teeth chattered. His yellow eyes squinted balefully at us as he passed forward. I thought it my duty to remonstrate. "Why are you always knocking him about, Dominic?" I asked. Indeed, I felt convinced it was no earthly good, a sheer waste of muscular force. "I must try to make a man of him," Dominic answered hopelessly. I restrained the obvious retort that in this way he ran the risk of making, in the words of the immortal Mr. Mantellini, a damnition damp, unpleasant corpse of him. "He wants to be a locksmith," burst out Cervoni. "Oh, learn how to pick locks, I suppose," he added with sardonic bitterness. "Why not let him be a locksmith?" I ventured. "Who would teach him?" he cried. "Here could I leave him?" he asked, with a drop in his voice, and I had my first glimpse of genuine despair. "He steals, you know, alas. Par ta madden. I believe he would put poison in your food and mine the viper." He raised his face and both his clenched fists slowly to heaven. "However, Caesar never dropped poison into our cups. One cannot be sure, but I fancy he went to work in another way. This voyage, of which the details need not be given, we had to range far afield for sufficient reasons. Coming up from the south, to end it with the important and really dangerous part of the scheme in hand, we found it necessary to look into Barcelona for certain definite information. This appears like running one's head into the very jaws of the lion, but in reality it was not so. We had one or two high, influential friends there, and many others humble, but valuable because bought for good hard cash. We were in no danger of being molested. Indeed, the important information reached us promptly by the hands of a custom house officer, who came on board full of showy zeal to poke an iron rod into the layer of oranges which made the visible part of our cargo in the hatchway. I forgot to mention before that the Tremolino was officially known as a fruit and corkwood trader. The zealous officer managed to slip a useful piece of paper into Dominic's hand as he went ashore, and a few hours afterwards, being off duty, he returned on board again athirst for drinks and gratitude. He got both as a matter of course. While he sat sipping his liquor in the tiny cabin, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.